Welcome to the Leadership Mindset Podcast with me, Tony Brooks, where we look to revolutionize your leadership mindset by changing how you think and see your world, enabling you to do the right things and grow significantly as a leader. Welcome back to the Leadership Mindset Podcast series. I'm very pleased today to have with me Felicity Wingrove, otherwise known as Fliss. So Fliss is one of the UK's leading experts in the applied psychology of language. A true master of language, for the last 25 years, Fliss has supported some of the world's leading businesses, brands and leaders to communicate with impact. So she works with CEOs, MDs and C-suite execs, ensuring they become the most powerful and persuasive communicators possible, which means that that's whether they are delivering a speech, the speech of their life, creating powerful connections with stakeholders, or connecting a board who are in dispute. I'm sure that never happens, does it, Fliss? So, welcome, Fliss.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. No, lovely. I mean, we've had chance to meet two or three times before and found you fascinating, Fliss, which is what, and also entertaining. So I thought you'd make a great guest today. So just for the benefit of people who are listening to this who don't know you, what's been your journey to where you are today then? What's brought you to this place with this deep fascination in language?
I think it started with language, with a fascination. So my undergraduate degree is English language and linguistics, but it taught me how to deconstruct language to its smallest sensical parts, and then how to put it back together, often in a very nuanced way, not wildly different, but I started to see the impact that that could have. And I started my career post-graduation writing political speeches and copy to influence and persuade. And I've gone from there. I've worked in the defence sector. I've worked primarily agency side. I used to run one of the big national PR agencies. And most of my career was spent in public relations, so very much in that persuasive, informative kind of space. I set my own agency up, 17, 18 years ago. And a couple of years ago, added another business to the kind of mantle, which is focused around this applied psychology of language. It's always been my passion. But it's taken me until now, 25 years of really not, I refer to myself as an applied psycholinguist, because this isn't just about having the knowledge and the expertise. Actually, it's around understanding language use within that kind of corporate culture and corporate construct, and the power that it has to unlock real potential.
Yeah, and that word applied is important, isn't it, Fliss? Because I think I've got a fascination in psychology in a broader sense. But I think it is, it just has so much more purpose when you start to see the benefits of how you can bring that knowledge, understanding, and you know, big part of what you do. I noticed you said in all that you've been involved in writing political speeches.
Yes, absolutely. Love it.
Anyone you'd like to share that you've been involved with?
Absolutely not.
I thought you might keep it confidential. Anyway, it was worth a try anyway, Fliss, wasn't it?
Oh, important ones, but very much back in their day.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, back in the day. Okay, then, so what is it, as you say, you brought in an additional part to the business, which is this sort of applied psychology of language piece. So what is it that you do as a psycholinguist then?
It's all around this ability of language to empower. My real passion is giving people a voice. And the business came off the back of writing incredible speeches for CEOs and then, quite frankly, watching them stand up and butcher it. You know, the words were fantastic, but actually, if the delivery isn't there, it's not going to achieve what you need. And I felt such a some of these speeches, some of these words were so important because it was around galvanizing a workforce behind a complete change of business ideology or business approach. And it was necessary for the function of the business, for the business to continue and for people to have those jobs and for the supply chain to be supported. So it was a real responsibility. So I started working with the leaders to deliver that speech in a really authentic way. And it's about this authenticity piece. You know, I had someone say to me the other day, isn't this all really contrived? Isn't this really controlling? But to me, this is around taking command of how we're perceived. It's the equivalent of getting off the Eurostar and speaking French when you're in Paris, rather than English loudly and slowly, yeah, and then getting frustrated when your message doesn't land. So I'm teaching CEOs, business leaders, to communicate with impact, but also to communicate with integrity. And that includes the words that they're using, but it's also around their physicality. It's around their voice. It's helping them to be their best, the best version of themselves, but also the version of themselves that their team deserves.
And I guess a true representation of who they are as well. It was interesting when you were saying then that you've helped put together speeches and then see them go wrong. What kind of things do you see when they go wrong then? What are the kind of things that you're identifying there?
For me, it's very much around that disconnect with stakeholders, with team. You see, when someone is leading an organization and they are that their team, their stakeholders aren't following them, you get that real disconnect. You start to see it in productivity stats. You start to see it in recruitment. You know, there's a leaky bucket. People are leaving because they don't believe what the leader believes. And actually, you also start to see it in things like sickness and absence. You know, it really does have a physical impact. If you're part of an organization and you don't feel psychologically safe with the leaders that you have, even if it's at an unconscious or subconscious level, you are not going to be okay. And to me, this is one of the lessons I try and teach the boards. You know, this is your responsibility. This isn't a nice to have. You need to make sure that every person under you knows where they're going, why they're going there, you know, what they stand for. And if you're not gifting them that, then you are doing them a disservice.
Yeah. So really, it was when you were talking about speeches going wrong, it's not just necessarily the delivery of the speech at that point in time. It's things around that aren't congruent with the words being spoken at the time, then, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen some really horrific examples of speeches where someone is just ticking boxes. You know, they're standing there. It's almost I'm showing my age, but you know, the spitting image puppets. You can see the mouth moving, but there's just nothing there that actually feels genuine. But I've also seen CEOs stand up and deliver a speech which is basically saying that 20% of the people listening are going to be made redundant. He delivered it with the integrity, with the emotional resonance, just really, really grounded. And what couldn't have happened is that his top 20% could have gone to their competitor because they're the ones that can pick up the phone and get a job tomorrow. But they didn't. They believed what he believed. They understood why he was doing it and they believed in him. So actually, they stuck it out. You know, a few of them said, I'll give it 6 months. There was a little bit of reticence. This wasn't all, you know, sort of holiday camp. But actually, that business reshaped and became wildly successful and was able to continue to invest in its team and continue to do what it does, give back to its community. You know, it's a really good firm and it's very much more strong and empowered for the future. So sometimes change needs to happen. But when we manage change, it's down to leaders and their communication to actually hold the space.
That's a really great point, actually, because I mean, often speeches, communication is going to be negative sort of information or things that aren't going to be necessarily well received. And even more important then to get the delivery of that right, because that can go so badly wrong if that's delivered poorly, can't it, Fliss? So,
completely.
Yeah. And don't worry about spitting images back on the telly now. So you're not showing your age because it's resurrected, hasn't it? So you're okay with that. Why do you feel words in particular are so critical for leaders?
I think it is around that psychological safety. It's holding the space for people, but it's also around leaders being able to have the impact that they intend. So, you know, having spent 25 years in PR, I've always talked about more and bigger and better and bolder and huge adjectives, and it's all jazz hands and excitement. But actually, when we talk about language, and particularly the language of leadership, it's around deliberate and reliable and replicable and scalable. And they're not sexy words, but my goodness, they're important words. This is about leaders making sure that their message lands exactly as they intend, even when it's been repeated, Chinese whisper style, 20 people down the line. But it hasn't been misunderstood. It hasn't been misrepresented. Worse still, it hasn't been forgotten or lost. And actually, for me, the onus is just on the leader. The onus is absolutely and always on the leader, on the person who's communicating. It's down to me to make sure that my message lands with you. It's down to me to have the self-awareness of what's going on for me and what might be going on for you so that I can pivot my language, I can pivot my communication style and approach, I can pivot the stories that I'm telling to illustrate it. I'm whatever tactic or technique or tool I might be using, that's on me. And if it doesn't land, if you don't get it, if I offend you, if I create some disconnect that makes you feel disengaged or disenfranchised, that's on me too.
Yeah, and there's a big empathy piece that's coming out here, Phyllis, isn't that? From what you're saying, is that understanding of another person's potential perspective, their world, so that you can deliver words in a way that will land better with them and that they will connect with better, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So empathy, and how do you think that leaders can be more empathetic in their communication then?
I think a huge part of it is recognizing their own filters, their own preferences, their own biases. And I use the word bias. It's a very triggering word for a lot of people because it comes with a fear of you know, cancel culture. But a bias is just a way in which we view the world that is separate to others. You know, if we can remove temporarily from a psycholinguistic perspective, but just remove some of the negative association there. And when we recognize what's going on for us and we recognize that our window on the world is not, we're not looking at the world through clear sunglasses. We're looking at the world through stained glass window sunglasses that are made up of our lived experience, our cultural paradigm, yeah, our education, even our health, nutrition, sleep. All of those things are going to impact how we perceive something. So I'll often say to leaders when we're training or I'm delivering a speech or it's a sort of one-to-one coaching, your truth is absolutely your truth, but it's not the truth. This is around perspective.
Brilliant.
I talk about a three-dimensional diamond being in the center of the room. If you're looking at a single facet of that diamond, you're only going to be able to understand a part of the whole. And you need to recognize that other people will have a different perspective that is equally true. And that's quite a, On the face of it, that's a really simple concept. But when you start digging down, particularly the leadership level, because you'll know as we start to rise through the ranks of the corporate ladder, a lot more ego gets involved. And actually, you know, well, this is how I want to communicate. So this is, they can damn well listen. And it's a case of, well, that's great. Well done you for standing in your power. But ultimately, if you want to be truly empowered, what about we unpick all of this and you start showing up how your team needs you to? You can see why I'm good at boards and dispute, can't you? Bossy.
No, but I absolutely love the way that you put that, that it's your truth, but it's not the truth. Mm-hmm. I think that is such an, but if there was nothing else from this whole sort of time that we spent together today that leaders should take away, I think that statement in and of itself, Bliss, is so important. Because I think, I don't know whether you agree with this, but I suspect you probably will, that leaders can get to the place where they think they have an objective definition of the truth, and they don't. They, like you said, they're always coming with experiences, subjectivity, and what have you. And so, we're never really dealing with objective truth, or rarely. I mean, you can get certain elements of data and what have you that you might say objectively there is something there, but most of the time, we're all dealing with perspectives and interpretations and subjectivity. And I think leaders, I've found that in my experience, that sometimes they might believe that they have a definitive, you know, view of something, and it's not. It's still their view. That's a great
completely.
One.
Truth, we tell ourselves so many stories. That's the thing, and it's human nature. It's how our brain has evolved. Storytelling, and those stories can be really compelling, but quite often the stories that we tell about ourselves are the most compelling of all. We create the self-identity and we need to step into it. And it can be quite confronting if you're asking a leader to step outside of that story, to step outside of that identity and to show up differently. But that is what brave leadership, you know, I talk about this brave new world because COVID changed the face of leadership because it changed the face of employee expectation and stakeholder expectation. No longer can leaders get away with some of the behaviors and approaches that they once used. And quite rightly, actually, there's a lot more accountability and a lot more visibility, I think, for just around that whole communication piece and them showing up. It's, yeah, I talk about the Brave New World. I think Aldous Huxley might have had that one first, but I'm just borrowing it.
It's a great book, though. I must admit, I've not read that for a long time, but Brave Leadership. Yeah. And I again, you're taking us probably off at tangents, but that's all good for this.
Oh, who's surprised at that?
Yeah, but I think that as you were talking about the impact of the pandemic and I guess more flexible working and all that kind of thing, it makes communication actually even more important, I believe, than it was before, because often we don't necessarily have the direct face-to-face communication in the same way we might have had before. And so for me, when you talk about brave leadership, I think leaders also need to make sure they're putting the effort in to communicate still with people, because I think it could potentially lead certain leaders to be a little bit lazy with it. And the when everyone, I mean, I'm not saying obviously a lot of organizations are still there in the offices together, but it is a different world now. And
Yeah, that whole hybrid working piece, completely right, Tony. It's changed the face of everything, and communication is what's holding it together. We're seeing communication. I'm working much more post-COVID around culture, around inclusion, not just from a diversity perspective, but from the those that are working remotely, those that are working in person, those that are hybrid. There's a real sense of them and us around that. So bringing people together, giving them the vehicles to be able to communicate, but actually also giving them the confidence to be able to communicate in different ways, whether that's being able to really feel empowered while you're on a Zoom call or Teams, or whether it's over the phone or whether it's via, some kind of chat system that you might have, the virtual kind of system. It's exciting times, but it's also very leveling times. We're seeing firms that when people were in person had a really great kind of or a really low attrition rate, really great retention. And actually that's starting to change. They're starting to get to double digits in terms of people leaving. And the prime reason, when you really drill down, is that they no longer feel a part of something. Is that real? Are they no longer a part of something, or is that a lack of communication? They no longer feel that they're a part of something. And only the individual can answer that. But I think communication has a long way to go in those organizations.
Yeah, and I guess it's as you were sort of touching on there with things like chat software and that kind of thing. There's a danger inherent in all of that, isn't there, Flish? That a lot of the times, again, probably getting into a more traditional, I guess, environment, where if leaders have something to communicate, you would either get potentially a newsletter or you'd get people together periodically and communicate messages. Shifting a little bit, and the use of things like chat software and what have you, there are dangers inherent, because communication that's just words, as I'm sure you'll expand on in a moment, has got its own is fraught with its own dangers, isn't it? Because you don't get that physicality that you were talking about right at the beginning. You don't get tone of voice, you don't get all of those things, really.
It's so tricky. It really is. I'm doing a training for an organization in the next month or so who are transitioning their customer service team primarily to a chat function. And they recognize that it's a potential brilliant opportunity, but actually it's also a potential risk because we no longer have the ability to mitigate possible miscommunication by listening to someone's tone of voice or looking at their face. We bring all of this information in and we combine it to give ourselves this impression of what's being said. When it's just words, there is so much more likelihood that you are going to be triggered by a word that to me is semantically neutral. Actually, to you, it will be really packed with not just negative connotation, but actually, really, it can be quite triggering. And we can cause quite significant disconnect by choosing the wrong words. And yet we are putting our teams into positions where they don't recognize that their truth is not the truth, that their language is not clean. There's no language hygiene there. It's loaded with all of their personal perception and loaded with their personal experience. We've got to teach them to clean it up, to remove all of that so that they're communicating in a much more neutral way.
Yeah, that's an interesting expression you use there. I wonder if you could quickly expand on it. You talked about language hygiene.
Oh, I
What does
love
that
that.
mean?
I know
What does that mean for you, Phyllis?
So language hygiene to me is quite literally cleaning up what's going on for us. So we're wandering around the world in these Elton John-esque stained glass window sunglasses, carrying suitcases full of baggage when it comes to the nuance of language and words. So I talk about semantic density. Words carry a density, and that differs per person. You know, we've got the dictionary definition, the denotation, we've got the connotation, the societally accepted and approved understanding of a word. And then we've got the boatload of baggage that we each carry. And what a word will mean something very distinctly different to me than to you, even if we're looking at it through the same cultural paradigm. But if we come from different cultures, my goodness me, if English isn't your first language, you know, all of this is layered as more likelihood of disconnection and miscommunication. So language hygiene is a recognition that this is all the stuff that's sitting between me and the truth. Well, I'm going to clear it up, or I'm going to bring awareness to it. And it's going to allow me to have the very best success or the best chance of success to present that message to you as I need you to hear it or see it or feel it, depending on your sensory preference.
Hey, wow. What a brilliant metaphor that I've got in my head now of walking around with big Elton John sunglasses with a big heavy suitcase taking around with me as well to represent
Sunglasses, Tony.
the filtering and experience that I have in life. Yeah, no, love that metaphor. That's fantastic. Do you think that I mean, you touched on I guess the area of sensitivity a little bit, you know, wokeness and all of these kind of terms that I use, which I think is interesting. What do you think? Because some leaders will really buy in, I guess, to the need to be sensitive with their communication. Other leaders less so. What kind of advice do you give leaders on that kind of front?
I mean, ultimately, authentic communication is authentic. This isn't about you pretending to be someone that you're not. But as a leader, I would question why it would be in your interest to disengage some of your workforce, to offend them, to create some kind of divide between you and them, or to create some sense of psychological or emotional or mental lack of safety. And when we're talking about inclusive language, it doesn't mean tick boxing. It doesn't mean using language that is incredibly liberal and expansive, because that in itself could be triggering. It's a recognition that we are all very different, and that we can express what we want to say in a really considered way that is very much more likely to land with people that we're speaking with. So I wouldn't use the word woke, because it's what I would call it. It's a word with particular semantic density. So were you to have right-wing leanings, woke would be something that's a parody and you would be sort of a little bit sneery about it. If you were left-wing leanings, you may identify with it, or it may make you cross because it's a misrepresentation. People in the middle might be bored with it because it's one of these words that it will die a death in the next 12 months, as these words do that are completely overused. What does it actually mean? I would suggest that it could mean one of three or four things. What do you mean by it? And it's around actually drilling down and being authentic in your understanding, and not relying on words that can be misconstrued or misunderstood. Instead, making your message really plain and really clear, and standing and explaining why you believe it.
Plain and clear, yeah. And that piece about semantic density is making more and more sense as you're talking about it, that certain words like woke, there are certain words at a particular period of time that I guess have that semantic density. You touched on an area I was going to come to actually, in that I was going to talk to you or ask you about and you've been touching on some of this already, Phyllis, but how leaders get communication wrong and right. And you touched there on being plain and clear. And I must admit, one of my channel, I was just putting together the back cover of my book at the weekend. And my tendency is to overuse words rather than underuse them at times. And my wife was doing a good job actually of simplifying my message. And I guess that can be a challenge in your field as well, that people don't simplify their language enough and aren't plain and clear enough. Would that be fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And that doesn't mean that we have to use, you know, we can't use Latin language. I mean, I think words are the most beautiful thing to me. A beautiful poem or a really well constructed piece of prose is like a piece of art. You know, it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. There are times I'll read something and I almost have to stop and catch my breath for a moment. My husband thinks I'm very overly dramatic, but words are beauty. So I understand this isn't about taking them down to being functional building blocks. But equally, we need to ask ourselves what we're trying to achieve. And I liken it to cooking. You can create, you know, 3 pints of sauce, or you can condense your flavors down so you've got a really rich jus that you may only need a spoonful of. The beauty, the taste, the flavor, all of the wonder is still there. And it's very much easier to access when it's a smear on a plate than when it's coming in kind of a massive great gravy boat. That doesn't mean there aren't occasions that the gravy boat is what you fancy and what you need and fit for purpose, but condense your message down so that it's the most compelling and the richest version. And it allows people to access it because not everybody has the ability to process a lot of information. This is one of the challenges I have with leaders. They will sit in their profile, their preference. And they will speak to others. So there are four information density preferences. So that's if I needed you to do a task, if I was your manager and I was briefing you, I could give you a one-liner. I could give you a chunky paragraph. I could give you a few bullet points underneath it. And then I could keep going and give you a colored Gantt chart. And that's the right way to brief in that order. It's the reason that web pages are designed in the way that they are, because people can read and take the information they need. And then select out, you know, self-select. If you're a detailed leader and you're talking and you're giving someone a brief for 10 minutes, you're going to start causing psychological stress. If they're a big picture person, you're going to start seeing them blinking too frequently and, you know, sweating. And because it's a tsunami of information and they literally can't weed out what you need of them. So it's things like that, you know, just I'm a big picture person, so I'm really conscious. I would give my team a one-line brief of why we're doing what we're doing. And for me, that's wonderful. And I'd skip happily off into the sunset. But actually, I've got team members who are very much more how people. They need to know the nitty-gritty because they want to deliver success to me. And if I don't give them the parameters that they need, it's incredibly stressful because they feel that they're running around like a headless chicken without any sense of structure or direction. So that's one of the ways that leaders get it wrong. And also how they can get it right. It's very much the same. You know, if it's how do you get it right, we're just going to do that.
No, I like that as well. It's that sort of likening it to a website as well, almost, Fliss. But that again goes back to empathy, because it's understanding that some people will want just the big picture view, high level view. Some people want the detail, and so actually providing information or communication in a way where you can move through those levels so that you satisfy everybody. That's a great way of looking at it. It was interesting you talking about beautiful words and what have you. I just went to see the new Bob Marley film. I'm a big fan of Bob Marley, so I went to watch One Love at the weekend. And one of the things that I always think about him anyway, but I came away from it, was that he was just an incredibly beautiful poet in the way that he wrote. So I love the way that Bob Marley used words. And I guess there's different environments for different use of, you know, different use of words. And if it's, you know, if you like, as you say, I think language is an incredible thing, and it's great to have those opportunities, whether it's poetry, art, whatever, writing a letter to a friend or a loved one, you can actually express some of that. But sometimes when you're a leader needing to deliver a message that is both clear and compelling, you've got to potentially look at your use of language there. And what I've liked as well throughout when we've been talking is you've been great in terms of using metaphors and visual representation for this, because I think a lot of people, it's not one of my gifts, I would say. I endeavor to do that more, but you've been naturally using some really great metaphors to help people connect. And I think that's probably another thing that leaders can do well, isn't it? To use metaphors and visualization to help people understand things more.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for that lovely compliment. I do try. So I'm very conscious that my natural style is kinesthetic. I'm very much an emotion, a feeling. I wave my hands around much more than perhaps I should. I'm slightly more controlled on stage, but I get very excited. And I'm very conscious that a lot of the population are not kinesthetic, they are visual. So I try to paint a picture with words, and I'm conscious of some of the descriptions that I use so that they will meet the needs of an auditory listener. I don't cycle through the other preferences because those three cover about 80% of the population. So we're pretty good, really. But it is about landing your message and not being afraid to bring it to life in some way, so that the other person can, again, they can understand exactly what you mean in the way that you mean it. Because I do genuinely believe that great communication is a win for everybody. I'm keen to what you said about this whole, descriptive and beautiful words. I got into this game, kind of psycholinguistics. I've done that many postgrads and qualifications in the last 25 years. What really started me off was Martin Luther King Jr. and Winston Churchill, leaders at a time of significant change, who were calling people to do something. It wasn't just difficult. There was physical harm involved. This was taking someone to a point where their physical safety, health, even their life was absolutely on the line. And they used their words to great effect. Winston Churchill, rather than using a three-part list, which is what our brain expects, when he accepted the challenge from the British people to lead a government at a time of conflict, said, "All I have to offer is blood, toil, tears, and sweat." He didn't stop at tears. We would have thought he was an emotional or too emotional for the job. He didn't stop at blood. He stopped at sweat. And what we thought was, this is a man who's going to work really hard for us. It made us feel we were in safe hands. This is a man who will go as far as we need him to. And he was a leader at a time that he was the leader at a time that the country needed him. Martin Luther King Jr., again, absolutely beautiful. Bob Marley, if you look at some of the cultural and societal paradigm that he was operating within and that he was fighting against, the language that he used, Bob Dylan was one of the best poets of a generation, in my opinion. He just put his poetry to music. And we see it again and again, words being used to create emotional connection, to drive enthusiasm or awareness, to incite a desire for change, no longer can we hide behind not knowing suddenly that we're compelled to act. And that's the beauty of language for me. It's the most beautiful thing.
And the power of it, anyone listening to this would remember I Have a Dream. I must admit, the thing that stuck in my mind when Barack Obama was first going for, when he went first president, first term of presidency, he kept using the phrase, "Yes, we can." And it was simple, but it was really impactful. And you see that.
It links into a concept. So Milton Erickson, he was the grand, you'll be aware, but as the grandfather of NLP, and he talked about artful vagueness and this ability to use a phrase, "Yes, we can do what?" It doesn't matter. It's artfully vague, and it allows me to read into it and you to read into it what we want to. Whether you love Brexit or you are a staunch Remainer who is ruining the day, take back control. Really powerful use from a psycholinguistic perspective. It wasn't take control. That was coercive. That's controlling. That's aggressive. Take back control. All we're doing is taking back what was ours. We're restoring. There's a righteousness to it. You can feel it in the language. Did that help a lot of people who probably would have voted Remain and wouldn't have gone over to Leave because they were kind of the crazies? Suddenly it felt very much more rational and right and just and not right-wing crazy. And I don't doubt that it had a massive part in opening some potential voters' eyes. Language and action again.
Yeah, it's true. And I guess what's interesting, I mean, I've not heard of that phrase, artful vagueness. Thank you again, Phyllis. That's an interesting phrase. But I guess it's the power of language, but also the danger of it as well, potentially, because with just simple phrases, you can influence people down paths, can't you? And I guess that comes with the power of leadership, right the way up into, political leadership, heads of countries, heads of state.
We see it very much with Trump in America at the moment, language the divide. I'm a fan of language to include and language to empower and it all being about a win, but actually you can absolutely use language. You can wield it as you would a weapon. Shakespeare and the pen is mightier than the sword. Actually, completely true. And what Trump's done really successfully is he has galvanized people behind certain phraseology. So he'll say false news or fake news. And everybody has a shared collective understanding of that. And it's horrific because it means that they're no longer interrogating anything. They're just taking his word. I'm getting political now. I probably shouldn't. So sorry, Tony.
No. Hey, perspective.
I started in politics. You can tell, can't you?
We're all allowed that, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that language should be deployed deliberately and with genuine care for the other person. That a communication, however that looks and feels, it could be an email, it could be a physical face-to-face exchange, but it should be a win for everybody. And it should not be. I do work with domestic violence charities where I work with women, particularly women and children, who have had their voice taken away, have been told a story that they have come to believe, and I'm helping them to start to unpick that narrative because that language in that case was used to coerce, to control, to subjugate.
Wow, yeah.
And there's nothing clearer than in that particular example, because quite often it is coercion and control. It's not the traditional physical violence that you may expect of domestic violence, but it's no less harmful, hurtful, devastating.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And that just brings home to me the absolute responsibility that we have as leaders, because our words matter. Our words and the intent with which we share them absolutely matter.
Yeah, totally. And I think great work that it sounds like you're doing there, Fliss, with, you know, domestic violence charities. And that phrase again that you spoke about, you know, where wielding words as a weapon, probably, well, I wouldn't say never more important, but what an incredibly important area where words can be used in such a powerful way to control, coerce, undermine people and what have you as well. And as you say, that same responsibility or same power moves into different arenas, and words can construct and destruct, can't they? You know, it's that simple,
completely.
Really.
Yeah,
I mean, I share, obviously, you've gone much deeper into language over your career and your lifetime. But I do think language is fascinating. And obviously one of the reasons I thought it would be great to get you on today. But the more you go deeper into it, the more you realise that as well, that the intricacies of it, the sensitivity, the power, all of these things, or we think we're just communicating or speaking or typing an email, but wow, the power in that and the danger of getting it right and wrong.
So true. I know, to think about different preferences, my husband is ex-military and he would prepare an email without the dear or the hi or the he now knows he'll go back in afterwards and put in, I hope your weekend was great. He'll fire off quite a functional email. And actually I see the response that can get. People can start telling themselves a story that, you know, he's chasing something up, he's crossed with them, or, you know, oh, what does he think? And a lot of energy, emotional and physical energy, is expended trying to build a story to explain a blunt email that doesn't need to be expended if we spent just a tiny bit longer to craft an email that is very much more grounded. And it may be that we recognize that that person has a sensitivity. Perhaps they're, you know, that they're a little bit prone to taking things personally. So instead of saying, where is the report? I know you're working on the report, just checking you can get that to me by 2. Suddenly it doesn't have the shame. It doesn't have the judgment. I know you're working on it. There's just a little bit there. I'm giving them the ability not to get offended, because actually it's in my interests and theirs that they don't, because they're going to do their best work. I'm just reaffirming the deadline that I have. It's really small changes like that. And taking responsibility. That's what it all comes down to. I keep saying it, but we need to take responsibility.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I could almost hear leaders saying as we're talking about it here, I haven't got the time to be trying to, you know, finesse and whatever, you know, when I need to communicate to get something done. But as we're saying, the danger is then you miscommunicate, you get it wrong, it causes even more problems. But again, we're going off on a slight tangent, but I thought it might be interesting to talk about this for a moment, Fliss. I, again, work nowhere near the level that you do in language, but one of the interesting exercises I've done with people sometimes is to give them an example of an email communication about something that's gone wrong and ask them how they would improve it. And there are two or three things particularly that come out of that. One is that the email doesn't have that finessing around it. So it's straight in, blunt. There's no relationship building or anything in it. The second one is it's not very assertive. Sometimes communication can be too wishy-washy, can't it, as well? You know, you need to get this done. But why, by when? And what actually do I need to get done?
Absolutely.
So I sometimes find communication is wrong there. And then the third thing I find is sometimes it's good to break. I think more and more in modern life, this attention span seems to be being lost more and more, is to break things down into bullet points, digestible, break down things down into more paragraphs. And what's your view on that kind of thing, really, about terms of...
100%, absolutely. And it's about delivering your message in as succinct a way as you can. But for that person, you know, going back to what you said before, the leaders that say, I don't have time to finesse. Well, that's great. Spend your time on recruitment instead, because you'll need to. You know, spend your time filling the leaky bucket. But all of the leaders who say things like that, I don't have time to finesse, you find that they've got a really high attrition rate, that they're spending a fortune on recruitment and on training. And because they've got newbies in, their clients aren't getting the service that they're expecting. So they've got a whole team who are there to try and stroke clients and stop them leaving. And actually, if you just got your damn communications right in the first place, you could sort all of that out and then you'd have plenty of time. So I always get frustrated whenever someone says, oh, I don't have time. It's like, but you don't have time not to. And in terms of those communications and being dynamic, I'm not suggesting that we all try and have some identikit style, that there is a perfect style that we need to marry and follow. Actually, very much more, it's about being you and being authentic, but recognizing if you have a very short, sharp, blunt style, just give someone either side of it, a quick bracket either side, a softening, an understanding, just something. If your style is really verbiose, give someone bullet points because they're going to skim ahead. Make sure that you tell someone what you want, why you want it, how you want it, but you give them that. It's going back to the style that we talked about before, the webpage, compelling headline, chunky paragraph, couple of bullet points, and then you can offer more information. But as a leader, it's absolutely fine to say to one of your team members or all of your team, has this landed? Can I clarify? Can I give you any more context?
Yeah,
allow people that. To self-select. It's not a lack of power on my part and a checking in, have I done a good job? It's I've given you core information. Do you have everything you need to feel resourced to deliver this task? And if you don't, that's absolutely okay, but you tell me what you need and I'll get you more. You know, this is a collaboration. This is a win for everybody here. Then actually by asking that question, you have to deliver it in a way where someone does feel psychologically safe to put their hand up and say, actually, no, I'm not there yet. I need a bit more. You can't roll your eyes and tut when they say that. So they'll never do it again. You know, create the space of curiosity. You start to learn your team. And this can be a team of several thousand people. You're doing this for your senior team, but you're empowering them to do it for their team and onwards. And actually, this kind of cultural change embeds really quickly and it pays dividends really quickly.
And again, just picking up on your point about how has my communication landed or has it landed, I think one of the techniques that I've found really useful over time in terms of communication is paying back to somebody your understanding of something. One of my coaching clients, when we were talking about some things, he's said, can I just play that back to you to make sure I've understood? And he played it back and we weren't totally on the same page. And that's often the case. You can so often, can't you, Fliss, whether it's written, verbal, whatever speeches, you can walk away and think, well, that was the message I delivered, but the person I received him, well, that wasn't the one that I received.
No, exactly.
Really
powerful to say, okay, so what I'm hearing right now is, can you give them the opportunity to go, yes, absolutely. Or, well, no, that isn't what I meant. Okay, great. Can you give me more information? But it's about maintaining. I always think this is about being grown up, being a grown up as a leader. You have to marshal your own thoughts and feelings and create the space for someone to express themselves. That doesn't mean that they get to be overly dramatic and, you know, and badly behaved. It's not about permissiveness, but it is about curiosity, professional curiosity. And actually really listening. You know, we've talked before, active listening is a really powerful skill and it's one that is wildly and woefully is underused within leadership. Listening of any description, let alone active.
Yeah, and that is the thing about communication, isn't it? It's not about delivery of messages, it's actually listening on the other side and actually being prepared to listen when somebody responds back to your communication, which isn't always the case for
Completely.
leaders. Yeah, that's for sure.
No, sadly.
Wanted to ask you another question about, again, with leaders, the way they communicate their choice of words. How can they use their communication and words to repair and heal things more? You know, when people are stressed, overwhelmed, overloaded, there may be a conflict within the organization between people. What kind of things can leaders consider to heal, repair more, and use language in that way?
Great question. I think it's all focused around the language. It's the language related to culture. So you're looking at language to build deliberate rapport so that there's a connection. You're looking at language to create a sense of safety. And again, I've touched on this a few times, but
You
psychological,
have.
mental, emotional, and physical safety. You're looking at language to demonstrate integrity. That's hugely important because quite often, if you're looking at repairing, then trust has been eroded. And rapport is one thing, but actually, you need integrity as a foundation stone to rebuild trust. Values, language that doesn't just tell core values, but actually demonstrates them.
Yeah, great.
And all of that as well, there's that sort of commonality. You know, we are driven very much by filtering, firstly, on the whole, for people like us, rather than people who are different to us. So creating commonality, whether that's shared aims and aspirations, there's also an aspect there of honesty. I think, you know, it sits within the integrity piece, but if you're looking at repairing a relationship, quite often you need to own that something didn't go right. And you need to own your humanity. And there is an art to doing that without showing up as so vulnerable that your team don't feel safe.
But it's been humble, isn't it, Fliss, as well?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I've seen leaders stand up and get really emotional and cry, and actually, that's awful. Yes, we want people to be vulnerable and to apologize, but no one watching that will have felt that they were in a safe place, that they were being led. You know, having someone come up and be quite measured, but sort of say, "Do you know what? We got this wrong, and I'm really sorry, but I want to talk to you now about how we're planning to move forwards. I want to listen. I want to learn. I want to improve. Please be brave. Please tell me. But just know, you know, it's that kind of language.
Yeah,
It's
brilliant.
authentic."
Yeah, really love that. Really love that. Okay, then just a couple of final questions before we come to the end, and people can find out more about where to find out more about you, Fliss. First of all, what's your you talk about language. What's your favorite word?
You know, it's almost like which is my favorite child.
How many children have you got, Fliss?
I've got two, a 5-year-old girl and an 8-year-old boy, and I love them both equally.
You
They're
love them
very
both
different
equally.
personalities.
Absolutely.
I do, I do. I love words equally as well. So between the three of them, I love really unusual words. So there's a word, I don't know if you've come across tricor.
What,
Tricor,
sorry?
tricor, PETRICHOR, tricor. And it's the
Okay.
smell after rain. You know, when it's
Oh,
rained and you
okay.
open the window or you go outside and you just have that moment of like sensory immersion in the freshness, in just the earth. And
Right.
there's another one, which is called sonder, SONDER, sonder. And that, I love that. That's realizing that every passerby has a life that's full. They have their own world that they're carrying. So it's almost that wonderful curiosity about humanity. And I get that sometimes when I find myself in a quiet moment and I'm a behavioral psychologist, aren't I? So I'm going to be watching people left, right, and center. But I just recognize that each person is in their own very full and wonderful, vivid world. That's Sonder.
Yeah, love
So I
it,
had
love
two.
it.
That was really greedy, isn't it? But I
You
did get, I
allowed
did
it.
away
You
with
allowed
it.
it because that's going to lead me on to my next, well, sort of final question, really, which is, I've been talking to a few people about having a word for 2024, and I was greedy and had two, so I had optimism and enjoy. So those are the
Love.
words that guide me. And when my email system went out on Friday, the optimism and enjoyment sort of went by the wayside a bit. But you've got to keep regrouping now. I wonder whether you have a word for 2024, or if you'd be comfortable sharing one or two, Fliss. You're allowed two if you want.
Always, I've done exactly that, and I think it's really powerful. I think having a word, it creates a framework through which we can run our decisions, just to check in that we are still aligned to our own integrity. So, I've carried forward last year's word, and I've chosen another word for this year. So last year my word was ease,
Okay.
and for me, again, it's a little bit artfully vague because it means so very much, but it's around being easeful, sitting in contentment. But also, I think there is post-COVID, we've had this real big push and hurry, and we were trying to catch up, and we were trying to get back on, and we were just trying. There was a lot of that, and so last year I set myself a challenge of ease, which was having real moments of connection and contemplation, and sometimes taking the easy road and recognizing that it doesn't have to be hard.
Hey, that's
So I'm
good.
carrying that on because it's still a bit of a journey.
Yeah, good. And your new one?
My new one is abundance, and it's not
Okay.
just abundance in terms of the traditional sense of kind of material things. It's an abundance of experience, an abundance of emotion, just an abundance. I want, in an easeful way, obviously. I just want, I want to have all the laughs. I want to have all the connections with my friends. I want to have the abundance of time, just the abundance of joy, really. Because we
Lovely.
don't know how long we've got left. Without wanting to be all morbid, hopefully another 100 years for all of us in great health, and it's going to be wonderful. Actually, let's kind of grab life by the short and curlies while we've got her, and enjoy it, her as much as we can.
Yeah, no, I like that. It's interesting actually, because optimism for me, I've had it before as a word as such, but it was new, but I carried forward in joy. Because I think it's, and you know, Fliss, I did a TEDx talk in January. And one of the things that I focused on a lot on the day was enjoying it. Because you can get so wrapped up in the, it's important. I can't forget my words. Can't do this on the other. I just thought, enjoy it. You know, you're as prepared as you can be. And I think it helped me a
So
lot
wise.
going into it, just thinking, I'm going to enjoy this. So I like the idea of carrying forward words. That's great. No, brilliant. Thank you. Hey,
Absolutely.
it's been wonderful, as always, to speak to you, Fliss, but even better to actually be able to share it with other people by recording it. So that's
Oh, thank
amazing.
you for the opportunity. You are just, but it's been such a pleasure. I love chatting to you, Tony. I love the podcast, but I love chatting to you, and it's just been a gift. So thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, gift for me too. So before we finish, though, very importantly, how can people connect with you, Fliss, find out more about you, what you do, if they want to inquire about, you know, how you might be able to help them?
Or if they just want to connect and geek out about words, that would be welcome. LinkedIn is my absolute love platform. So I love LinkedIn. I've met some it's really fascinating people there. So on LinkedIn, I am Felicity Wingrove, the joy of having an unusual name. There's no additions needed. Or the website is it's the hyphen ultimate hyphen advantage.com, and we share quite a lot of content on there, and there's some examples there of ways that anyone could work with us. But do connect, I mean, particularly on LinkedIn, connect, share your word of the year or your favorite word with me. I'd love that. I can have a proper little geek out then. But really, and I share loads of content on LinkedIn as well. It would be lovely to connect.
No, brilliant. And yeah, but just to be clear though, it's Wingrove, WingroveE. So if you're looking
It
for
is.
Felicity, that's where you'll find them on LinkedIn. It's always best to connect first on LinkedIn, isn't it? I think. And then people can, as you say, have a chat, just talk about favorite word of the year, and then go from there, really. But hey, no, brilliant, Felicity. Thank you so much for appearing on the Leadership Mindset podcast show. And pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Tony. Have a great rest of your day.
If you want to explore your leadership mindset in more detail, why not complete our free leadership diagnostic at thetonybrooks.com and subscribe to this podcast to join us for future podcasts.